Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Welcome back to New Books in Hindu Studies. I have the distinct pleasure of speaking with Simon Broadbeck, who is at Cardiff University, on his wonderful new translation of the Harivamsa, Krishna's Lineage. Hello, Simon, and welcome to the program.
Hello, Raj. It's lovely to be here.
Yes, and Simon and I have had some interactions in the past. We met at a conference in Bangkok, I believe, and we have various interests. Mm-hmm. If this was a few years back, I was on this post, I would be interviewing you on your last book, your Mahabharata Patrilaine book. I found that book endlessly fascinating, only because I ended up discovering that I think the Markandeya Purana agrees with you on what you say in that book.
Thank you.
You're most welcome. But we're here to talk about Krishna's lineage. So this is a translation of the Harivamsa. Maybe you can say a little bit about, what is the Harivamsa and how does it relate to as the subtitle says, to Vyasa's Mahabharata?
Yeah, well, the Harivamsa is a collective shorthand for the so-called Kilas of the Mahabharata, that is K-H-I-L-A, which are effectively, they are books of the Mahabharata, that is small books in the 100 book scheme of the Mahabharata, which are not contained in any of the major books. That is, they fall after the end of book 18 of the Mahabharata as it's usually conceived. And so they don't, they're included after the end of the story of the Pandavas, basically.
And so, sorry, go on.
So, after the story of the Pandavas has been completed by Vaishampayana at the end of book 18 of the Mahabharata, then at the beginning of the Harivamsa, more is asked about Krishna and his family, the Vrishnis, and the frame that just closed at the end of Mahabharata 18 is reopened again, so that Vaishampayana can answer Janamejaya's question and tell a whole lot more material about Krishna and his family. So that takes up most of the Harivamsa, that is the first two books of the Harivamsa. And then in the last book of the Harivamsa, that is the last Kila, the so-called Bhavishya Parvan, the book of the future, we get a very, very interesting sequence of stories about Janamejaya, who, of course, was the king who heard the story of his ancestors, the Pandavas, and then the stories of Krishna during the course of his snake sacrifice. And so at the end of the Harivamsa, we hear what happened to him later on, after the snake sacrifice and his further adventures. So it continues the Mahabharata and it finishes it.
It just occurs to me as we're talking that, if I'm not mistaken, this might be the first book which is a translation. And so it has there are other dimensions of the kinds of things I might like to ask you. But if you could tell folks what it's, how did you end up deciding to translate the Harivamsa? How long did it take you, and what was that like? What was that process like?
many years ago, in 2008, when I first came to Cardiff to work with my colleague here, James Hegarty, we were doing a project on genealogy in Indian literature. And so for that project, I started to translate the Harivamsha by translating specifically the sections of it that contain the genealogy descending from the sun and the genealogy descending from the moon. So that's how it started. And then having done that, after that project with James was finished, effectively, I decided I'd like to translate the whole thing, mostly because by then I'd become convinced that it was a genuine part of the Mahabharata. And since I'd been spending most of my career studying the Mahabharata, I thought I needed to get to know the Harivamsha. And not just me, but also other Mahabharata scholars. So there was a clear need for a new translation, not least because the Harivamsha was edited as part of the Mahabharata Critical Edition Project in 1969, and that critically reconstituted version of the text is very, very different from the so-called Vulgate Harivamsha, which is the only one that had previously been translated before that. And so really the Harivamsha as we now have it is much shorter and much punchier than the Harivamsha that the old Orientalists used to deal with. So that's why I set out on my project, but it's been a long road, really. I was lucky enough to receive funding from the Arts and Humanities Research Council from 2011 to 2014. But after that, my other academic duties got in the way slightly, and it was only when I had a period of research leave that ended a year and a half ago that I was able to complete the translation and, dot the I's and cross the T's.
It's no small feat. I mean, this is a huge contribution to folks who study Hinduism, particularly narrative, particularly the Mahabharata, the Puranas. And so can you give us a sense of what the process of translation is like? Are you looking at the Sanskrit verses in the critical edition? Are you, like, what is that process like for you?
Well, the way I did it was I got hold of a transliteration of the critical edition, which had been put together under the aegis of Peter Schreiner with a whole lot of colleagues of his, in connection with the Dubrovnik International Conference on the Sanskrit Epics and Puranas. So an awful lot of different scholars had agreed to transliterate from the Devanagari of the critical edition and make an e-version in Roman script. And so I managed to download that from the website of the University of Zurich, and effectively, I put the Sanskrit text in the left-hand column of an enormous Word document, and I gradually filled in the English translation in the right-hand column. And the process of doing that is essentially a process of making yourself move on to the next verse, because you will never be happy with your translation of any verse. And so the only way to actually move forward is by force of will, just by continuously telling yourself that you can come back and change it later if you need to. Over a period of several years, I managed to produce a complete first draft. And then at that point, I kind of knew what was in the text. And so when I went back and adjusted the first draft and turned it into a second draft, I kind of knew where the stories were going. But of course, in the second draft, I had to deal with all the mistakes I'd made on the first draft and all the bits that, where I just had to put something and a question mark for myself in order to move on. All the toughest bits were still waiting for me. But eventually I completed a second draft, and then I went back and revisited some of the more problematic passages for a third time. But in principle, there's no end to the amount of drafts you need to do before it's actually good enough. But you've got to draw the line somewhere. So yeah, eventually I bashed it into some kind of shape.
No, it's quite something. It's very accessible. The accessibility of the prose in English really obscures how difficult this would have been to render. Yes, and so one may thumb through this and not get a sense that each verse would have taken you a bit of time. Did you do it sequentially? It's a textured layered text like the epics and the Puranas often are. Were there certain sections that you prioritized, did first, or did you just do it from top to bottom, or what was that process like?
Well, apart from having done the genealogical sections first, the Surya Vamsha descending from the sun and the Soma Vamsha descending from the moon, I did do those bits first because that was before I decided to do the whole thing. But once I decided to do the whole thing, I did just start at the beginning and move forward. Yeah.
So I have,
from beginning to end.
I have two interrelated questions, but I'll frame them both up front so you can decide in what order or how you'd like to address them. The first question is, you know, what sorts of things do we see in the Harivamsha? Obviously, there's the Harivamsha, there's the Vamsha, the lineage, the line, the genealogy of Hari. But what sorts of materials do we see in there? And that probably relates well to the second question I had, which you touched on, you preempted, which is, you know, is this integral to the Mahabharata? Is this an epilogue? Is it an appendix? Is it a vital part of the story? Is it useful for interpreting the main story? Is it sort of, I have this phrase in my brain I call Trojan horsing. Is this just Trojan horsed into the Mahabharata for ideological reasons? And so if you could address both those things, what do we see in the Harivamsha and to what extent do you feel that it is integral or not to the Mahabharata?
Thanks. Yeah. Well, it's an enormously varied text. I mean, the first book, the so-called Harivamsha Paravan, is an enormous variety of materials, from long genealogical lists giving the family background of all the main characters of the Mahabharata and the Harivamsha. It's got a creation narrative right at the beginning, including, you know, the birth and establishment of the first king, and the cosmology of the 14 Manus who preside over the cosmos from beginning to end. It's got an awful lot of beautiful little stories interspersed within the genealogies. So, you know, some of the characters that occur in those genealogies are quite well known and attached to various stories, pithy versions of which are presented in the genealogy. It's got an overview of the various manifestations of the great god Vishnu, all his previous avatars before he came to earth as Krishna. All those beautiful stories are told here. It's got a long version of the so-called Tarakamaya war between the gods and the demons in times of yore. Very beautiful and extended battlefield sequence there between the gods and the demons. And then it contextualizes Vishnu's descent to earth as Krishna by giving a long account of the problems that the earth was having and how the earth went to Brahma and complained, and Brahma chatted with the gods and with Vishnu, and they decided they all had to come down to Earth to cause this huge war that that took place at Kurukshetra, which we've already heard narrated in the main part of the Mahabharata. And then in the second book, in the book of Vishnu, effectively it starts with Krishna's birth, and it goes through all the deeds of his childhood, how he killed his wicked uncle Kamsa, and how he had to move his people from Mathura to Dvaraka on the west coast to get away from the rapacious king Jarasandha. And then after the Rishis and Krishna have moved to Dvaraka, there's a sequence of what we might call the latter day adventures of Krishna, which principally concern his dealings on behalf of his family with his in-laws and with his son's in-laws and with his grandson's in-laws. So it really takes you right through Krishna's life until he must be really quite an old man. But it's not, you wouldn't like to call it a biography, because it doesn't finish at the end, because Krishna's death and the flooding of Dvaraka have already been narrated earlier in the Mahabharata in book 16, the Mausala Parvan. So that's left out of the Harivamsa. As I mentioned earlier, in the last book of the Harivamsa, there are, amongst other things, a variety of stories about what happened to Janamejaya after the snake sacrifice. So it is a wide variety of material, and it is told in quite a punchy fashion. You know, it moves on, it moves quickly, it doesn't drag. But it's mostly adventure stories. There's a lot of fighting. There's a lot of debating about what should be done. There's a lot of stories of marriages and children, because it's effectively a family narrative. And regarding the second question, I mean, I think I've started to answer that already, not just in what I said right at the beginning, but in what I said just now about how Krishna is intended to be viewed in light of the first 18 books of the Mahabharata. It doesn't repeat material that it's already presented there. But more generally, in the Western scholarly tradition, it has usually been seen as a later addition to the Mahabharata, or even as a completely separate text from the Mahabharata. But my view is that that's a bit of a mistake, because in the second chapter of the Mahabharata, there are several tables of contents that are presented. And both of the tables of contents that are presented there include the so-called kilas that make up the Harivamsa. So the Mahabharata at the outset views itself as including the Harivamsa, and this is also evident in the story of Janamejaya, because in the third chapter of the Mahabharata, where Janamejaya's story begins, the first thing we hear is that because Janamejaya's brothers beat up a dog that had done nothing wrong, the dog's mother, Sarama, cursed Janamejaya to suffer an unseen danger. And there's no clue given in the rest of the 18 books of the Mahabharata as to what this unseen danger might be. It's only when you get to the very last chapter of the Harivamsa that it becomes evident that what was referred to there in this curse is what happens at Janamejaya's horse sacrifice, when Indra, who is jealous of Janamejaya and in love with his wife, takes the form of the sacrificial horse. And in the famous scene of the ancient Indian horse sacrifice, where the chief queen of the king has to go under a blanket and at least simulate having sex with the horse, she's actually having sex with Indra. And when Janamejaya finds out about this, he's absolutely furious. And this is presumably the unseen danger that was referred to by the dog's mother all that time ago in Mahabharata chapter 3. So it does tie in. I mean, that's just one example of the nice narrative ways in which the Harivamsa is integrated into the Mahabharata. But I really am convinced personally that it is it's all part of the same text. And I'm interested to find out what this might do in future with our understandings of the Mahabharata. If we include the Harivamsa as part of it, we might be able to see it in new ways. But that's not what the translation's about, obviously. That's in a way my more general project that the translation for me forms part of. But obviously it can be understood and appreciated in any number of ways by any number of different audiences. And I'm glad to hear you say that you think it's nice and accessible, because that was one of the priorities for me as I was doing the translation. I was trying to tell myself, don't just translate for your colleagues, the people that you meet up with at conferences. Translate it for people who might not have read any Indian literature before.
Well, the word you end on there, literature, you know, it fascinates me that, you know, I have degrees that say, I studied religion, and of course I do. Obviously, I'm an area expert in Hinduism. This is why I can host this podcast. But at the end of the day, more and more, I have so much more in common at times with folks who do literary theory and who study literature, study narrative. And it seems to me that it may well just be because I have a similar approach, so it resonates. But nevertheless, it seems to me that the folks who study the Sanskrit narrative literature, the epics and the Puranas, the ones that have an appreciation and a flavor for literature, are the ones that can understand the ways in which these texts are literarily quite sophisticated. Although maybe diachronically produced, it seems to me that by the final redactions, there was an extraordinary literary eye at work. And that, to me, that is the juice of interpreting them. So the flip side of that is that very same literary appreciation in the toolbox of how you study these texts is probably part and parcel in why you were willing and able to render the translation in so accessible a manner. And this is what I mean. When I read through it, I don't know how to put this. Quite often when you're reading a translation of Sanskrit text, you can imagine you're very conscious of the fact that this is being translated out of Sanskrit. Yet in some passages in the Harivamsa, that awareness slips away from me, if that makes any sense. It very much reads like, as if at times composed in English, which for anybody who has any knowledge of Sanskrit or what an utterly different Twilight Zone world it is grammatically, syntactically, you know, for me, that's a feat. But yeah, for me, it reads extraordinarily accessibly.
Well, it's very kind of you to say so, and I'm very glad to hear you say it, because that was, one of the things I was trying to achieve. I mean, there is a famous dialect of English called Sanskritic English, which is what an awful lot of the translations have effectively been rendered in, where the word order in the Sanskrit has been retained, the strange ways of putting things, or strange from an English point of view, the repeated use of the passive and so on and so forth. So, yeah, I tried to mix it around and make it make it sound better, as good as I could make it sound in English, really. I mean, I'm not a poet, but it is poetry, and it shouldn't read like a crib from Sanskrit. No. But more generally, I mean, I totally agree with what you say about literature. I mean, I think the so-called epics and the Puranas have been not nearly as well served by the philological tradition of Sanskrit studies as a lot of other genres of Indian texts have, because they, you know, they are supposed to be accessible to all people. The Mahabharata and the Harivamsa explicitly say this is a text for all four social classes, for both genders, and, you know, there's not supposed to be anything elitist or recondite about it. So it deserves the literary treatment much more than some genres of Sanskrit texts do.
Are there parts of it that you, obviously parents can't play favorites, but are there parts or verses or chapters or themes that sort of, you know, that are your favorites of the text?
Well, there are certainly some passages where I was totally thrilled by what happened. Amongst Krishna's fights, I particularly love the fight with the demon horse Keshin, where in the course of the combat, I mean, Krishna's just an adolescent at this point. He's quite young, but he. The way he deals with the charging horse is he just elongates his arm, and he whacks his arm through the horse, front to back, and the horse just kind of falls apart. You know, the two sides of the horse crumple to the ground. And I mean, it's completely brutal. And actually, a lot of the fight scenes are quite horrific. But once you start to appreciate the cartoonish quality of the violence, that scene gave me particular pleasure to witness, and several other scenes as well. There's a lovely scene where, well, lovely is probably not quite the right word, but the dicing scene in the Harivamsa, which takes place at the wedding celebrations of Krishna's grandson Aniruddha, and Krishna's brother Baladeva is challenged to play dice by Rukmin, who is Krishna's brother-in-law and effectively the head of the family from which Krishna's grandson's new wife comes, and that's why they're there as guests for that wedding. So Baladeva is challenged to play dice in the same kind of way as Yudhishthira is challenged to play dice by Shakuni in book two of the Mahabharata. It's a similar situation in that everybody knows apparently that Baladeva is not very good at dicing, and the person who's challenging him is a known expert. And so, as in book two of the Mahabharata, Baladeva loses throw after throw after throw. And it looks as if it's going to go the same way as the dice match in book two of the Mahabharata did. But in both of those dice matches, there is a final throw where the stake is an awful lot higher than any of the previous stakes. And although Yudhishthira in book two loses that throw as well, in the Harivamsa's dice game, Baladeva, by some miracle or other, presumably because he is actually Vishnu, manages to win that final throw and effectively wins the whole game. But he goes crazy at the end because he's been humiliated during the course of the game verbally by his opponent. And so actually he ends up killing Rukmin with the dicing board at the end of the at the end of the scene. So again, it's brutal, but I did enjoy that scene in particular, and partly because it plays nicely with what the audience already know from the Mahabharata. And in that respect, there are quite a few scenes in the Harivamsha which have a kind of intertextual relationship with other scenes in the Mahabharata, as you'd expect. But it makes them funnier. It means that a lot is going on underneath the surface of the text, and it gives the reader great pleasure, basically, to spot the connections. So those are just a couple of scenes, but you know there are beautiful passages throughout. I mean, one of the highlights of the Harivamsha really is the descriptions of the natural world, particularly in the forest land where Krishna and Baladeva grow up, amongst the cowherding people in the forests outside Mathura. The descriptions of the river Yamuna and the coming of the monsoon, and the cows, are just absolutely beautiful, just stunning poetry. And the range of metaphor is quite constrained, in that the metaphors tend to be about the natural world, about weather, about clouds, about the sun. And this means that they're accessible, you know, because we all, you know, we all share the same natural world. So it's it felt like the poet was just able to talk to me person to person there.
Well, isn't that the mark of a great poet?
Well, possibly. I mean, I don't know very much about poetry, and there's all different kinds of poetry, but yeah, this is my favorite kind.
Now, what do you, in addition to obviously being an exquisite piece of literature, in addition to its aesthetic dimensions, do you have a sense of what the Harivamsha hopes to accomplish?
What does it hope to accomplish? Well, it is advertising Krishna's identity as the great god Vishnu very, very clearly. So one of the things that it is certainly hoping to accomplish is the encouragement of Krishna worship and Vishnu worship. I mean, it is a religious piece of work, and its attitude to Krishna, although very playful and, you know, in some ways slightly irreverent, it's very clear he is God. And so we are supposed to be convinced by that, I believe. And, you know, it's more and more convincing. During the process of doing the translation, I did think about the world in terms of Krishna more and more. So that's certainly one of the things it's trying to do. More generally, as part of the Mahabharata, I think it shares in the general task of the Mahabharata, whatever that might be. I mean, we're beginning to agree on some of the aspects of what the Mahabharata was trying to do. And one of those things is to combat the success of Buddhism. I mean, Krishna is a family man, and he's extremely responsible towards his people, towards his family, towards Brahmins in need, anybody in need. And I think this is a direct response to the story of the Buddha, wherein the Buddha is seen to renounce his social and familial responsibilities. He was destined to be king, but he ran away from home, and he lived his life as a wandering teacher. So, you know, that path was open to Krishna, but he plays his role in a very different way. And so, you know, I think that's one of the things that the Mahabharata does, is to encourage the householder role and the path of conventional responsibility. And Krishna presented in the Bhagavad Gita as the paradigm of the person who does his conventional duties without attachment. In the Harivamsa, we actually see that carried through in narrative form. We see him doing his duties without attachment. So yeah, there's that aspect. And part and parcel of that is a strong support of the Hindu class system and of the Vedic tradition against the heterodox traditions of Buddhism and Jainism. Brahmins are presented as worthy of support, worthy of respect, worthy almost of veneration, and certainly deserving of funding. And more generally for the Mahabharata, it is a story of a terrible war. And one of the things it does is to explain that war in divine terms as not just something that human beings were doing to each other, but as something that the gods were doing. They came down and took form in order to engineer enormous human destruction for the good of the earth. So it's not an ordinary war in any shape or form, but nonetheless, it does facilitate reflection on war from a human perspective. And one of the things I think that we see in the story of Janamejaya, who, of course, in book one of the Mahabharata, begins this hideous genocide of snakes. He, in order to avenge his father's death by snake bite, his plan is to sacrificially destroy all the snakes in the world. And partly as a result of hearing the story of his ancestors and the story of Krishna, he changes his mind and makes peace with the snakes. And so I think one of the general purposes of the Mahabharata and Harivamsa combination is to show the audience how cycles of violence can be brought to an end, how people can, you know, rise above the horrors that have gone before and forgive each other and move forward into peace. So I think it has a wonderful overall message. It certainly in those terms that is transferable beyond any boundaries of religion or ancient culture to be very relevant to our world today.
That sounds like a lovely overview of the broad strokes themes of the Harivamsa. Now, why don't you tell us, are you still working on Sanskrit narrative? Is this part of a larger project? How does this fit in, if at all, with what you're working on now?
Thanks. While I was doing the translation, I was conscious that I would never finish it if I kept on breaking off to write little articles about other things. So I did keep a list of side projects that I was hopefully going to get back to afterwards. And I have done one or two of those things. So I've written an article about Harivamsa chapter 83 in particular, which is the scene where Krishna's brother Baladeva moves the river Yamuna from one place to another forcibly with his plow. A very interesting and in some ways peculiar scene. I've written a paper on various possible ways in which we might interpret that deed of his. That's just a little paper, really. More generally, I've written a piece that I hope will be published in the not-too-distant future about what difference the Harivamsa makes to our understanding of the Mahabharata as a whole. So this is what I was saying earlier about integrating the Harivamsha into our view of the Mahabharata. And one project that I've begun, which I have to say has proved to be a much bigger project than I initially envisaged, and it won't fit into an article, is a study of one of the, well, what for me is one of the great problems or narrative problems or mysteries of the Mahabharata, which is how the idea of avatara, of Vishnu's periodic incarnation in the world, relates to the scheme of the four yugas, because it's stated on many times in the Mahabharata that the Kurukshetra war between the Pandavas and the Kauravas took place approximately at the end of the Dvapara Yuga and the beginning of the Kali Yuga. So that means that after Vishnu came to earth in the person of Krishna, the net effect was the world got worse. And it seems to be a contradiction of the avatara principle as everyone knows it from the Bhagavad Gita, which is whenever Dharma declines, I come into the world to punish sinners and to restore the righteous. So it's an apparent contradiction. I don't think anyone has really got to grips with it before. So I've been working on that and trying to see if we can resolve that contradiction somehow. And I hope that we can, because it's as I say, it's one of the tricky aspects of the Mahabharata, and previous scholarship on it has rather tended to try and make the problem evaporate by effectively just saying, you know, these two aspects of the text, the avatara aspect and the yuga aspect, are part of different layers of the text, were introduced comparatively late in the composition process, and, you know, we shouldn't expect them to talk to each other or to make sense in combination. And that's a plausible answer, but I wonder if that's the end of the story. I wonder if we can potentially do better than that. So yeah, that's my current project.
Sounds like quite fascinating work. You'll have to share what you come up with in terms of the Harivamsha as part of the Mahabharata whole. Definitely related to stuff that I look at. Yesterday, I just finally finished this manuscript looking at goddess and sun myths in the Markandeya Purana, which forced me to look at the Purana as a whole to make sense of it. And I'm glad I did, because counterintuitively, sometimes when you're looking at these, you know, various pieces of the text, there is sort of a meta-filing system at play. There is sort of an interlocking scheme that we often overlook, and it would be fascinating to see what you come up with in terms of the extent to which the Harivamsha is integral to the Mahabharata as a whole, as well as this other problem that I never really noted. It sort of was in the back of my brain, and it's not something that I've thought about, but, you know, I just assumed that Krishna was coming, or the avatara was coming, on the cusp of things going completely sideways as damage control for the last age. But at the same time, that's not an altogether satisfactory answer. But I did think the yuga cycle and the avatara cycle ideology, that they were, I don't think you can compartmentalize them. You know, there has to be a way to make sense of them. There should be a way. I'm not sure how the tradition does, but I sort of thought, okay, well, stuff's going sideways. It's Dharma's on the rise, so let's come down and restore the balance so that the world can survive the Kali Yuga. But at the same time,
right? So the things would actually have been an awful lot worse were it not for Krishna's appearance.
That's sort of how I had looked.
Yeah, well, I suppose that's one way of looking at it, but. Yeah, but I still kind of think that it would be nicer if if Vishnu actually made things better.
Especially after your time with the Harivamsha.
Yeah.
Fair enough. No, you have to share what you come up with. We've taken half of your time today. Maybe I'll talk shop with you for a couple of minutes after the interview proper. But for those of you listening, as you know, we've been talking with Simon Broadback from Cardiff University on his huge contribution to Hindu Studies scholarship, a modern, accessible, lovely translation of a very important text, the Harivamsha. Simon, thank you very much for being on the program today.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Okay, and for those of you out there, until next time, which will be the new year, this is the last one for 2019. Until next time, keep reading.